Today's program was brought to you by craftbeer.com, dedicated to small and independent U.S. craft brewers. For more information, visit craftbeer.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Adam Sachs, editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine. We'll talk to Adam about what else, all things wine and food. We'll also taste the Savoir Selects Petit Syrah for our weekly wine sip. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Adam Sachs is editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine, a magazine dedicated to food, drink, travel, style, and home. He joined Savoir in 2014 and has steered the magazine towards telling deep, elegantly written stories about what makes food so meaningful to people all over the world. Adam also has received 3 James Beard Awards for his writing, which ain't too shabby. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Adam.
Thanks, Sam. Happy to be here.
Before I get into your background, I want to start because you have an interesting background. You have a test kitchen at the office. You go to a lot of chef dinners. You attend festivals. I just saw you down at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
Right.
So my question is, why are you not a fat schlub? Because you're not.
This is radio, right?
Yes.
Could clock in at even 99 pounds. And
looking shredded.
Fat? Let's just find fat.
But
I'm sucking in my gut. We're sitting
but
here.
But you are around so much food. You have to be somewhat disciplined.
I'm not at all. I've been writing about food for a fair number of years now, and I've never been one of those people at a tasting or a review, when I used to do that, who could just have one bite and kind of think about it and process it and file it away. I finish things. If I like it, I finish things.
Good for you. You have a good metabolism.
Thanks.
So that's a good segue. So I want to you have an extensive background in traditional and digital publishing, certainly with a slant towards food. What I want you to do is talk a little about your background to the point, you know, where you're at Savoir right now, because you've been at some interesting places. So just give our audience a little quick background.
I'll skip birth and grammar school and bar mitzvah.
Kentucky. They have bar mitzvahs in Kentucky?
They do. They don't make a lot of great wine. They make a lot of good corn whiskey down there.
There you go.
They do have bar mitzvahs in Kentucky.
They do?
Yeah, a few, okay. Now and again. So I moved to New York about a year after I graduated from college, and I had a somewhat vague idea that I wanted to work in journalism and some sort of writing. And I ended up starting working at a magazine that folded and was a fact checker at Condé Nast Traveler for a little while. And when Time Out launched in '95, I wrote them a letter. I'd gone to school in London for a little while, so I was probably one of the, you know, not huge group of people who recognized that brand from London.
Yeah, for sure.
And I luckily was pre-email, I guess, so I sent them a physical letter, and I begged them for a job, and they didn't have anyone else, so they gave me a job. And I ended up editing the restaurant section there. And I thought when I started that I was also helping edit a consumer section and writing for different sections and doing some newsy stuff. And I didn't know that food would be the beat that I really fell in love with. But it was a great restaurants were a great way to discover the city, to write about the fall in love with the city, to get to know the city. Restaurants as sport, or the sociology of the restaurant scene here. And then I think, like a lot of people who write about food, I ended up feeling like I sort of fell more in love with food than restaurants. I still love to eat in restaurants, and I love the stories behind them. But I really wanted to find out where food came from, and I wanted to talk about the people who make it and the ingredients that make it come together. So I left Time Out. I was there for about 2.5 years, and it was a great introduction to New York and a great introduction to...
Were they fledgling? They were building it up? I mean, you were new, part of...
Yeah, I wrote for the first issue, and I came on staff for the second issue. And I was there for the 100th issue. I did a... I ranked the top 100 restaurant desserts in New York. So this is pre-blog.
You ate 100 different ones?
I ate 157 restaurant desserts. I was going through a breakup, so I think I was losing my mind a little bit, and I was...
It was your comfort.
I was finding comfort.
Yeah.
And not sanity, but finding comfort.
Do you remember back what stood out? I mean, was it like the dessert at Le Cirque?
There was. It's funny you say Le Cirque. I actually went... with Pete Wells, who was writing for us at the time, and we had lunch.
Pete was at Time Out New York?
Well, he was a freelancer.
Yeah.
He and I had lunch, a kind of lovely lunch at the Le Cirque in the old New York Palace, was it?
Yeah.
And at the end, I guess it was Jacques Torres at the time, who was the pastry chef there, and he sent out... So we were going places and having every dessert on the menu.
But the menu at Le Cirque is the size of the food menu.
We ate all of those.
Jesus.
And I remember one of the ones that I loved and put on, I think I ended up putting on the top 100, which is a lot, was this a banana tart. And I loathe bananas. I hate bananas. And I was just, it impressed me that someone could make something made out of something I hate. Tastes pretty good.
And you were able to eat it.
I'm not allergic. I just...
Do you ever go fishing or fish?
Bananas? No. Do I fish?
Yeah.
I'm not a fisher
because
person.
Because your bananas on a boat are bad luck.
Oh,
that's
okay.
A whole separate story.
Well, I know where to go then. I want to make sure I don't find any bananas.
All right. So you leave Time Out New York.
I got a job. I started writing for GQ magazine.
Good
and,
gig.
An opening came up there, and I got a job as a staff writer there. And I wrote about everything from, you know, pants to murder to doing book reviews to, and I would every story I would try to get them to send me somewhere where I could eat. And so even if the story wasn't about eating, I would try to get them to send me somewhere where there were good restaurants and where I could eat. And then I was there for 5 years and did some food writing, not a lot. Alan Richmond was the alpha food writer at the time there.
Right.
My first day, he introduced me to everyone as the backstabber. He had claimed I'd come to take his job, but that never happened.
First day on the work, you made the guy paranoid. That's good.
Yeah, I think he's still writing for the magazine. He's 170 years old now.
And yeah.
He's a real...
I still see some pieces.
He's still plugging away. He's great. And so I was there for 5 years, and I left to go freelance. And I accidentally stayed a freelance travel and food writer for 11 years,
wow.
Which is way too long to do something like that. But I spent most of that time. I wrote about different things. I would still do some celebrity stuff or style stuff or sort of general.
You wrote about some pretty high profile celebrities.
I did. Well,
McConaughey.
Yeah, I used to do Farrell. some details, which is now sadly shed. I did some of their sort of.
Can I just
covers.
Tell you one thing? Yeah. I worked at the Soho Weekly News.
Okay.
In the late 70s, and a lot of the people from Soho left and started Details, Annie
That's
and
right.
David and all those
it was
guys.
Down to, it was on Broadway, right?
But
it
morphed into a more commercial magazine.
Yeah, when Condé Nast bought it.
When they bought it. Yeah,
moved it to Midtown. But for most of those 11 years, I was writing food stories that were travel stories or travel stories that were food stories, but generally trying to keep it in the, you know, going places and eating good stuff.
Were the any of the James Beard Awards in that period?
Yeah, all of them were.
They all were.
Yeah.
And technically your freelance beer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was nominated once when I was at GQ for actually it was a 3-part story. I wrote part of it. Alan Richmond wrote part of it, and Adam Rappaport, who's at Bon Appetit now, wrote the other part. And we were nominated, and we lost. And it was rough, but we survived.
So you won in 13 and in 2014, right?
I know I won in 13 because because my daughter was born the next day.
Right.
So
I have in my notes.
Hard to forget that particular weekend.
You did a story on ramen in search of ramen and a rosé trip to Bandol. Do you remember those?
Yeah, this is why they give you a medal for this sort of, hard, hard-hitting,
a rosé trip to Bandol. Well, obviously you said something right.
The ramen story was in Fukuoka in the south of Japan, and that's a story where I was thinking, instead of having these long multi-course meals, it's just a bowl of soup, so I could hit 3-4 restaurants a night, and then you land in the second one, you're sweating profusely and you're dizzy, and your body starts, by day two, your body starts to revolt. And there was a lot of ramen for that one. The other one was I don't think I won for the rosé one though.
No.
But thank you for bringing it up because I always thought I should.
Yeah, there you go. So 11 years, couple of James Beards in there. Then what happens?
The daughter who was born the day after winning a couple of them. It's not that I did it to exhaustion, but I did try to travel a lot, and I would string together stories, and I would be away from home for a long time, and that was fine when I was single,
right. Your life changes.
Without kids. Yeah, and I didn't want to be, on a pretty beach somewhere, FaceTiming my kids and trying to explain that I'm writing, again, hard-hitting journalism about how pretty this beach is or how good this sandwich is.
So it's time to get a real job.
So it's time to get a real job, and I managed to convince someone at Jeff Bartikovics, who started Tasting Table, hired me to be the editorial director of that. And that was a great gig because it was a mixture of stuff I knew about, which was how to tell stories and put together stories about food and food culture, and some stuff I didn't know about, which was managing people, which was digital side of things. And
that was your first step into real digital, right?
I mean, of course, any kind of writer now writes for, if you write for print, you also write for digital.
Right.
But
it
was the first time.
That later.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first time I had thought about it from a editing standpoint or a business standpoint. And the other nice thing about Tasting Table was that we had a really lovely test kitchen, and it allowed me a chance to sort of bring people who I admired in. We did a book party for Rene Redzepi when his book came out.
From Noma,
little known place.
Who just closed his restaurant down, right?
Well, they're Yeah, they're moving.
Right.
They're moving.
Right.
Yeah, a couple weekends ago.
So you're at Tasting Table for how long?
I was there for not quite 2 years.
2 years.
A little
and
longer.
You went on to
Savour. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
I was going to ask you, is it Savour? What are let's go through the potential.
Oh no,
Savour,
Savour,
Savour.
I get Savior a lot, which
Savior.
Sounds, yeah, a little more reverential than we need.
So that we continue the show on the right track, it's Savour.
That's as good as I can do it.
Okay.
I'm from Kentucky, so.
So you got to Savour in late 2014.
End of 2014.
Yeah. So you're already into a couple of years and a few cycles and all of that. All right, so I want to talk to you about the magazine a little. You recently said in your editor's notes, you said with all the events happening in the past year, and I mean the election and the world and all of that, you said...
Oh, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean...
Yes, you did.
You're reading between the lines.
No, I'm not. You said we read the news, we wonder at the state of things, and we seek comfort in familial nourishing rituals.
Yeah.
So my question is, and I think this is what you led into and what you were alluding to, why is food so important to people? I know it's a very general question,
yeah.
But, you're a food magazine and there's a mission statement and a goal.
Right.
Why, tell me your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, speaking for me as a person and not necessarily on behalf of the brand, you could obviously just have food as fuel. You could just eat to stay
sustenance.
Sustenance to stay alive, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if that's your how you,
but it's born. More interesting than that.
I just think it's the only thing that we sort of think of as part of culture that's that intimate, that you put it into your body, that if you're feeding someone, if you're making food for someone, you're giving something that they ingest, and it affects how they feel at that moment, it affects how they feel later, it affects their health. There's also the social side of it, that when you sit down to eat with people, you know, you're it's an intimate setting. And it's a way to sort of be with people in a way that's different than just sitting around a table and not having any food or drink between you. And I think if you like to think about food and where it comes from, and you happen to like to cook, then it's a whole other dimension where you want to spend time with the people who make it. You want to think about where it comes from. I get a lot of pleasure just from being in the kitchen. In that editor's letter that you referred to, quoted from, I was talking about making stock.
You're stock obsessive of the
yeah,
moment.
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn, so I need a bigger freezer. I need to get a chest freezer for the basement, but you know, that there's something.
So every bone you have and carcass, yeah. You're saving it, yeah, and you're making stock.
I wait till the guests leave, and I pick all the chicken bones off their.
So you make stock with used bones?
Yeah. I don't know if that's not suburb. That's not an official test kitchen approved technique.
I'm not trying to get you fired.
No, I mean, but there's something about, even if you're not, I like to throw a dinner party. I like to cook for friends. I like to cook for my family. But I also just like it once the kids go to bed, to have some little project that I can kind of do from muscle memory, not really think about it, lose myself in the activity of a little bit. And then you get something that is going to be delicious, hopefully, later.
Right.
And it you know, pays dividends down the road.
I've followed you on Instagram, and I would say you're a fairly experimental eater. You would eat the organs of a lot of animals.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they're not walking around still. But yeah, and they anything what? But a banana. Anything but a banana.
Right.
This is why I'm going to be on on a boat soon.
Like a skewer of yakitori chicken hearts is fine versus a banana.
Yes, I like any day.
Now, also, you built in your house in Brooklyn, you built a wood-burning fire grill, which is not typical.
Right. For those of you listening outside the Brooklyn,
do not try this at home
area. That's not, most apartments are not outfitted with wood burning.
What compelled you to do that?
So we were renovating a place. We got very lucky and found a house that we could, a wreck of a house that we could afford to spend way too long and too much money renovating. It had, in the kitchen where we put the kitchen, there was a wall that had a hole behind the wall, so there had been a fireplace, we knew, and I was thinking, all right, let's open this up. And we could only afford to open up one of the there was another one in the living room, so if we're going to open one, let's do it in the kitchen, because there's something so nice about a hearth, about fire in the kitchen. And
incredible.
Even before I thought about cooking, and then I thought, all right, let's bring it up to sort of, you know, waste level, so we could cook on it. And then it was right about the time that Ben from Grill Works was starting to make some get some notice in restaurants and start to put his grills, which are the ones, these cranks that go up and down, sort of a South American style.
Like parias.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was trying not to say that because I don't know how to pronounce it. And I called him up and I said, can you do this in a home? And he said, sure. And so after a lot of conversation back and forth between him and our contractor, who's kind of suspicious of the whole thing, and my girlfriend was very suspicious of the whole thing. We decided to put this in, and it's fantastic. It's essentially just a piece of metal that goes up and down in a fireplace, but
it's wood burning, right?
It's wood burning, wood or charcoal. We put a exhaust fan on the chimney so that it would help with the draw, but it already has a pretty good draw.
So in the suburbs where I'm from, you barbecue year round because a ribeye tastes better on a barbecue.
Absolutely,
maybe in a cast iron skillet, but I'd rather. Do you forego the barbecue for that?
That is my barbecue.
You don't have to barbecue in the
backyard. Yeah, that is my barbecue. I use it year round. I try to use it at least once a week. And it's once you. I mean, I've been living in Manhattan for 20 years before I moved to Brooklyn.
Ain't no barbecue there.
I had a couple little, you know, tiny terraces with tiny barbecues on them. But I didn't have a lot of grilling experience. So there was a real learning curve.
Have you come to the point where you're starting to perfect?
I mean, I'm not going to go up with, like, you know, against some Argentinian master or something.
Do you have a preference, let's say, to hickory wood versus cherry, or you're not there?
I think I'm pretty good at using touch and sense and smell and right. sight to see if stuff is done. And I really get a kick out of trying to end up doing whole meals there. So I'll grill bread and put something grilled on that, and then a big piece of protein, and then the vegetables, and then while we're eating dinner, put some fruit or something, and
right.
let it get smoky. I've tried different woods. I don't have a strong preference.
Right. For it. All right, let's talk about the magazine a little.
Sure.
So, Savour is a food and lifestyle magazine. I said earlier, it's travel, home, beverage, and all of that. How does the magazine differentiate itself from other food magazines? Because there's some well-known people in the space, so sure. you want to get your imprint out there.
And I like all our competitors right. and friends, both the people who run them and the products
good people.
Themselves.
Yeah,
I think Savour, our place in the food media landscape, and it's changed a lot since the magazine was founded in '94. I mean, you think about. Pre food blog, really before this explosion of interest in food and food media. I think now what we do really well is tell stories, and we give context and we have stories with voice. And while we give recipes, I mean, it's a food magazine. It's not every issue is sort of full of something to make on a Wednesday evening when you've got 60
the
minutes.
Recipes wrap around the stories.
I think
in
so,
a lot
yeah.
of ways, but the stories are very in depth.
Yeah, the line I always use is that we follow food to its source, and we want to know context, we want to know the personalities behind things, we want to just tell good stories. And so I think you could be a Savour reader and read different food magazines or your pick of online food outlets, but what we try to do is really have real voice, real sense of place, beautiful photography, and give people some context for what they're eating.
I was reading the current issue on the plane coming back from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, and I was reading that story on Pu'er tea.
Pu'er tea, yeah.
I'm like, I got to get some of this,
yeah.
but it seems like it's going to be very difficult.
It's expensive.
But it was about tea from China, very far away, obscure. I think that sort of tells the way the magazine is. It gets into a story that's exotic in that one,
and
in depth.
Right. And if you told me... if you showed me a story that it was sort of a tasting notes on tea or a comparison of tea or the business or the, just tea story, I'm not a big tea drinker. But when Max Falkowitz, who wrote it, started talking to me about the story, he's talking about this, beautiful part of the world, this sort of swashbuckling subculture of people who are sort of secretive about where they source the tea, the way that the tea, this explosion of interest in this thousands of year old product has changed the economy there. They've gone from, small hand built homes to sort of McMansions in a generation. And it's just this story that, could run in the New Yorker or Harper's or the Economist it's a food story, but
right.
you don't have to go into it loving tea to be taken, along for the ride. And it turned out to be a really cool story.
It was a cool story. And there was a little sidebar about teas. So
yeah, there was
you're
about
done
the packaging
with it.
Or
it's
about
like,
the,
what
how
is this?
Made.
Where do I get it? Can right. I? And it talks about that. So that sort of leads me to, how do you select stories? I mean, you have a big world, a lot of food.
Sure.
I mean, that's a pretty obscure, tea's not an obscure topic, but
right.
that type of tea in Yunnan, China,
right.
wherever it was.
Right, tea's huge, but, half the population of the planet lives on.
How do you select stories? I mean, do you know what you're doing for your November issue? What
some stories.
How do you decide?
I think you try to do a mix of reaching out to writers you know and admire, see what they're interested in. I'm a recovering writer first before I'm an editor, so I trust writers. I want to trust writers. I want to know what they've seen. You know, we get around all of us on staff, but
they pitch you.
So you're listening. You're talking. You're soliciting pitches, and then you're also thinking, okay, what haven't we written about? You know, what parts of the world haven't we visited in a while? And then, you know, explicitly or not, I think you're sort of thinking about what's in the zeitgeist. What's, you know, if we've done Copenhagen, what's happening in Oslo? Or if we've done tea, is there, you know, did Max the writer find some a food story along the way? And then it just becomes about figuring out the mix. You know, you don't want to do too much of one type of food. You don't want to do too much of one region. You don't want to feel like you're doing something because it follows the trends, but you also don't want to do something that you feel is 5 years too late.
Do you feel it's not important for the magazine to follow trends? To some extent, it would be yes, but do you feel you kind of follow your own way?
I think you want to be timely and you want to be on top of what, or, you know, a little ahead of what people are thinking about and talking about, but you don't want to be feel that you have to follow a trend, because then you're going to be behind it. And also the fact that it's trending in Bushwick or it's trending in Baltimore or wherever, it doesn't maybe lend itself to a great story. So I think story first, you know, can our audience is obviously our reader. Can we inform and delight and get them to keep reading a story? But the trends, you want to know what's happening in the world, but you don't want to feel like you're just kind of hitting notes because you've seen them on menus across the country.
So answer two questions for me. The first one is, has anyone ever pitched you a story?
On air?
Not on air. I'm not. Pitch, you know, one of your writers pitched you a story that you were unsure of, but bought in.
But turned
and
out
it
okay.
Either blew up or good or bad, you know, that you regret.
I'll leave the regrets to off-air comments. But, yeah, you never know. I mean, I'm a peculiar editor in that I spent most of my career as a writer. I trust that writers you trust and voices you like, that they're out there finding this stuff. And so you want to build in room. You want to leave room for kind of the joy of discovery in a story. You don't want to feel like you've edited it or you've assigned it to a point where there's nothing for them to find out.
Right.
On the other hand, travel's expensive. You know, we pay our writers a fair rate, and so you want to make sure they come back with something. So certainly, I mean, I tease on my mind because you mentioned it. You know, I was hoping T would be an interesting story because it was a compelling pitch, but I was really glad that, you know, with how
it was
came
an interesting
in.
Story.
And that's something where that's a part of the world I didn't know, and a subject I'm not inherently you know, knowledgeable or interested in. So that was a happy surprise.
The second question was, did you do a story way ahead of a trend? Like the tea story, you know, Pu'er tea could be, you know, is there an example you could cite where you were on something 10 months, a year before? And then
at Savour or just as a writer?
At Savour.
Yeah. You know, I've only been there for a short time, so who knows if the trend is going to hit. I can't think of something where we were sort of, you know, predicted it.
Right. Coconut water or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, we did a story a couple issues ago about the campaign to bring cultivate breadfruit, as there's a breadfruit institute in Hawaii, and there's a push to sort of, it never went away, but to really bring it back into the mainstream of the diet there, both for health reasons and sustainability reasons. And that's one of those things that, you know, it we felt like it was a compelling story. And then we'll know, you know, in a couple of years if they were successful with that. Or
right. It'll take time. I want to talk to you about digital and mainstream media because you're fairly well prepared to talk about it, because I think your tenure at Tasting Table and, you know, all your other gigs that you mentioned. Is there a divide between digital and mainstream media? And
when you say mainstream, you mean like print,
magazine, print magazines? Yeah. And you know, has digital changed publishing?
Oh yeah.
How has it affected Savore, your experience specifically?
I think the broader issue is that when people talk about food writing or food media, we talk about it like it's this monolithic thing, but it's an umbrella that covers, you know, restaurant criticism. It covers talking about sustainability, politics, recipes, restaurant cultures, celebrity chefs, the history of cuisines. So the nice thing about, the magic of the internet is that you can reach all that, you can talk about all those things. And then if you're a Savore reader who is interested in remodeling their kitchen, you can find something about style and design. If you don't care about that at all, you can skip that. Whereas in print, if we give, you know, real estate to something that is going to alienate a specific kind of reader, or we change up the character of the mix and people see something they're not expecting, that can lead to some unhappy letter writers.
Which so it expands what you can cover in a different offering.
I think it just broadens what you can do. I mean, I think the challenge for any publication or any brand or any editor these days is to have what you do across platforms feel true to the brand, but also right for the platform. So who we are and the tone of voice and every little granular thing isn't going to be the same in print or Instagram, right, or Twitter or Facebook or Pinterest or web, but it should be coherent. It shouldn't be, you know, six or seven different voices that, right, don't seem to hang together at all.
I find that a lot of the food magazines online for many years before I was reading Savore and met you, sort of a database for recipes.
There's a lot of that, yeah.
And it sounds like you're telling me and acting out, and I've seen it, you use the digital platform to expand the brand.
Absolutely, yeah. And digital will always be better at that. You know, when Savore launched 23 years ago, you got it in your physical mailbox. There, you couldn't be, there was a story about Corsican cuisine or whatever it was, you know, you read it and you'd either like the recipes or not, but you'd save the issue, hopefully.
Right.
And now if you're standing in line in the supermarket and you want to know about, you know, Corsican cuisine, you look
on
at
your phone
and there are 100,000 options.
It's crazy.
It's always going to be a better, you know, format or medium for
it's crazy.
A library like that.
All right, so this is a wine show. We have to talk about wine a little.
A little, sure.
I don't have to come over there and put you in a headlock and make you talk about wine. So a little earlier, I asked you why food is so important, just as a category. Same question. You know, wine.
I mean,
yeah, I think there's similarities.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I it's
tell
so,
me how you
it's
see
it's so
it.
Hard to not hit every cliche that, you know, wine is culture, that wine is it's communal, it brings people together, it goes well with food. So if there's something that, you know, is a complement to food, it just makes eating better. But, you know, the other side of it, it makes you happy.
Right.
There was a period when I got into food and I thought, okay, I'm going to be into food, but I'm just going to just steer clear of wine because it's this rabbit hole of specializing and detail, and I'm not good with numbers and math, and I'll never remember if it tastes like shoe leather or bootstrap or dried cherry or kumquats
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And then I've been very lucky to eat, been treated to a lot of meals or found myself a lot of nice dinners and meals, and slowly you're introduced to all this wine.
Wine is a critical part of that.
You love it, yeah, and you seek it out. I still definitely don't consider myself a wine expert, but
do you know what you like?
Yeah, I do.
All right, we're going to get into that later. But wine is an agricultural product.
Right.
So when we talk about food, you know, wine has similarities as far as sustainability, growing farmers and all
Absolutely.
Of that. And it's also a very social thing.
And it's got culture behind it. It's got story. I mean, that's
some of it goes way back.
I can't. My eyes will glaze over if I read, you know, numbers. But if you tell me the story about the winemaker or the region and how it got that way, I love those kinds of stories.
So there are magazines called Food and Wine. You know, other magazines that cover it. You cover wine to the extent that you want to. I mean, how do you determine your wine coverage?
I think it really comes down to stories. So, I think one of the conversations that we have, and I don't know if it's something that you think about for the show, is that, you know, how do you gauge your readers or your audience's level of connoisseurship or lack thereof? Where are they in, you know, in their wine knowledge or experience? And so how do you tell a story that is doesn't go over their head but doesn't condescend to them or doesn't bore them or doesn't tell them a story that, you know,
how do you find that, you know, how do you define that fine line?
I think the cover and the defense mechanism is to default to or to make sure that whether it's a wine that you're familiar with as a reader or it's new to you, if it's told with story, if there's narrative, if there's personalities, if there are scenes, if there's a sense of geography and place, and not just talking about soil structure and sugar, you know, percentages, then if it's a well-told story, you can, you know, I love when a magazine will, you know, like the New Yorker, when you're on a plane and you've read every story that you thought you were going to read, and you can't use your phone, so you read like the story about dance for me. Like, I would never seek out a dance column, but a well-told dance column is a well-told story.
So a well-told story,
and not to compare dance to wine, but I think again, like, just to have great stories, get at why this wine is important to the people who find it interesting and exciting.
So, in our next segment, we do a thing called the Weekly Wine Sip. Savor has a curated wine club called Savor Selects. When we taste the wine, you know, we'll talk a little about it. But before we move into our wine list, tell me a couple things. Tell me, and I don't know if this is a silly question, current trends in food and wine. I mean, what do you see out there? It sort of relates to how do you pick stories. I mean,
right.
What are you looking forward at?
I think, from an editor's perspective, or from when we're trying to think of stories, it's definitely easier if you're telling me about a region that you know is getting some acclaim that hadn't gotten any interest before, or if it's up and coming region.
Good current example? Do you have one?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Past one? Is it like Corsica or Sicily or Georgia in Eastern Europe? Yeah. Stuff like that, right?
Yeah, we had a story by a writer named Adam Gulmer a few months ago about Armenian wine. And Armenia is an interesting place because it's one of the birthplaces of wine. There's a cave there that the writer visited that has not the first winery, but some relics of the earliest known relics of wine storage.
Right. I think it's clay.
Yeah.
The big clay amphora, urns and all that.
And it's...
Amphoras.
Amphoras, yeah.
That's it.
And it's a cool story because now they're you know, 1,000, 6,000 years later or so, they're making wine there again, and the wine industry is sort of coming back. So there's a current event side of it. There's something you can go out and buy a bottle of it, or you will be able to buy the stuff soon. So I think that's a kind of perfect story because you've got history and culture and narrative. I disagree with some of my French fine dining friends. I really like biodynamic wines and funky wines, and you know, if it's weird and got chunks in it, I'm pretty interested in it. I don't know if that means I'm, you know, what that says about my taste. Or
since I've been doing this show, Brooklyn is a pretty big hub for organic biodynamic wines. The Four Horsemen, June, Ten Bells Company in the City. I mean, these guys feature it. There's a bunch of stores and all of that.
Yeah, I'm headed
Isabel
to a wine dinner
and
Contra after this.
Right, which is...
I love that stuff.
Yeah, the Raw Wine Festival was in Brooklyn. So there are a lot of people who support it, and some people, you know, who just shrug it off. But
and
it's,
I like that, and I would happily have that, and then have, you know, whatever gold standard of the greatest, you know,
Cali,
the
French Bordeaux,
or something. Yeah, I like both of them. I like those.
Have you done any stories on natural, organic, biodynamic wines that you could recall in the last couple of years?
Not as a trend. It's certainly they're winemakers who've come up in the stories,
right,
but not as kind of as its own standalone story.
Do you feel it's a trend, or it's? I think it's established. Already.
It's established, but yeah. I think, you know, it's like a lot of, you know, there are still magazines out there telling people it's okay to drink rosé. So what's established in some circles is still kind of you know, news to others. No, I think it's something that maybe what's interesting about it is that it's getting a little more mature, and that people are differentiating between you know, the folks who can do really good and interesting things, and yeah. the folks that some of it's just novelty and doesn't work.
There's a lot of cheerleaders, Pascaline, Le Pelletier, Caleb Ganser. I mean, there are a bunch of people, Justin Cherno at Four Horsemen.
Right.
I mean, these guys are good spokespeople for that.
Absolutely.
Tell me a few, and then we're going to break for our wine list. Tell me a few food people that are doing it right.
Food, I mean, people are doing
is
it right.
Is it chefs? Or, you know, are there advocates?
So many.
I always see Jose Andres always doing, you know, charitable stuff. I mean, does anything hit your radar?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question because there are so many people out there doing good stuff. I'm trying to think of who's impressive out there. I mean, I just randomly, off the top of my head, there's a guy named Blaine Wetzel. I did a profile of last year who... you know, I don't know if we were, you asked if we did anything that was ahead of the curve. I don't know if this is ahead or not, but he has a restaurant called the Willows Inn on Lummi Island in the Pacific Northwest, and it's just one of the more beautiful meals I've had all year, for
all
sure.
All local and everything sustainable.
And yeah, but it's also, I think what's happening in food that's exciting right now is that whether it's, you know, the South with... you know, what Sean Brock has done there, or what Renee and his team at Noma have done for, you know, getting attention for Nordic cuisine. There's now this next, or the next after that, interesting generation where they're learning from all that, but they're able to do, they don't have to be purist about it, and they can do food that's very personal and curious.
Those are great examples. Nobody even talks about Ferry and Adrian anymore. He's like an old fart or something.
Well, he's not an old fart, but they talk about it with reverence, with, you know, they elderly clothes.
But he's less top of mind than he was.
Yeah,
he's still legendary.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, someone like that had such a massive influence, there's bound to be, you know, people are looking for the people like me and people who get into traveling to eat or looking at rankings, or, you know, it like to think about what's happening, what's the zeitgeist. They're always looking for the next thing.
Right. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Adam Sachs. Adam is the editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine. When we come back, we're going to subject Adam to our wine list. And then we're going to taste the Savoir Selects Petite Syrah. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
Do you love craft beer? The diversity of styles and flavors? The stories of small brewery businesses and the communities behind today's craft beer movement? If so, you'll love craftbeer.com, published by the Brewers Association. Whether you tasted your first craft beer 30 years ago or just caught the bug last week, craftbeer.com is the number one destination for beer education, news, and recipes. Looking for a local brewery? Use the internet's most robust brewery finder to discover your new favorite place. Want to get geeky about your favorite beer style or find the perfect pairing for dinner? Craftbeer.com is the leading authority and can help. Celebrate the best of American beer. Visit craftbeer.com today.
We're back. We're back with Adam Sachs. Adam is the editor-in-chief of Savoir Magazine. And we've now handcuffed Adam to his chair, and we are going to subject him to our weekly wine list.
It's hard to drink in handcuffs, but I'm going to figure it out.
This is a series of questions. Answer them quickly. Don't dwell on them, all right?
You seem that when you ask me a direct question, I freeze up. I can't
think of it. I know. Jesus.
You asked me the names of my children. I couldn't even.
All right.
I could narrow it down.
I'm not going to ask you that. All right. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Are you drinking any wine at the house? Is there anything you've sort of got? Is it rosé? I mean, are you drinking a lot of Bordeaux? Do you remember drinking something currently?
I drink a lot of Morgon. I drink a lot of light reds. I like something like a lot of people where you could put it in the fridge and get a little chill on it.
Cru Beaujolais, Gamay,
I like all that
Morgon.
Stuff, yeah.
That's great stuff.
I like sparkling. I live in a close to Thirst, not to put in a plug. They're just people I like. Thirst wine merchants, and tend to go in and see what they're interested
in. Pick for you.
Yeah.
All right. So we don't ask people this, but, you know, you're a food guy. What are you eating now? Is there something? And I think the answer is stock.
Just
right?
Eating stock.
But, I mean, you're making stock. But is there something you keep going back to that you've been eating a lot of in the last few months?
I can't even remember what I had for lunch. I like, again, I have this crazy grill in my house, so I like to make things on fire. So
okay.
I do whole fish, or I do pork rack and let it cook for a few hours and keep it, you know, high up and let it get a lot of smoke.
So the answer is, you know, good use of the grill, whatever makes sense on the grill.
I went hunting my first time. Well, it was shooting. I went shooting. I didn't hunt because we weren't really walking. But we shot pheasant, and so I made pheasant rillettes, and that's very satisfying.
On the wood grill?
No, just I grilled the pheasant. It's hard. There's not a lot of fat. I just cooked it down in a mixture of olive oil and duck fat. I have a fridge full of duck confit right now. It takes me a little while, but then I remember.
It's coming back, right?
I did a dinner party.
8 pounds of duck confit fat in my.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I had. We did a dinner party and I with some friends recently, and I made everyone eat. Confit duck necks and goose necks. I realized I had about 10 duck and goose necks in my freezer.
There's this tender meat around the bone.
That's great.
Right?
Yeah, but you have to pick them up and it gets messy. It's like,
yeah, and there's not a ton, but you bite around
them. Yeah. Yeah, and then I made little puy lentils, those little French lentils with, I also confit the gizzards and cut them up. So there was all, and it just swimming in duck fat. So,
all right, so think about that, and you may have answered this, but favorite wine and food pairing.
So are we allowed to swear on this show? Is this a family show?
You can say whatever you fucking want.
I know. Thank you. I know that this is sacrilegious, and I know that you get letters and they're going to pick at the show or pick at Savour, but I think pairing is bullshit. I love to drink wine with food, but I don't like to think too much about the combination. Some work better than others. Some don't. But every time someone stops and says, okay, do you get it? Are you feeling it? The magic, the electricity.
People are overthinking it.
I think they're overthinking it.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
There's obviously some that there's a harmony there, and sometimes you get fireworks. But a lot of times, I feel like I'd rather just eat and drink and have things that generally go nicely together.
You're not overthinking it. Great answer. I accept that.
Thank you.
All right. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? New York City.
Yeah.
And then give me one anywhere from your travels.
Oh, no.
And I'm asking you about a restaurant because this is a wine show that has a lean towards.
Of course. I like, I mentioned the Contra Boys earlier. I like Wild Air a lot.
Contra
right
and Wild Air.
I think Wild Air is just, it's the way I like to eat right now. It's thoughtful without being fussy. Jorge's always got a magnum of something crazy
wine list
hidden behind his back, and he's just, you know, it just appears. The wines are fascinating. That's a restaurant that makes me really happy right now.
I think that's a great answer and sort of epitomizes the question. And they actually do wine and food pairing there. Jorge thinks about it.
But they don't make you think. They don't. Yeah, they do it. They don't make you think.
No. I'm joking a little. They do it sort of seamlessly.
Yeah, you don't have to stop and chew and swallow and look.
What about anything in your travels that was an oh wow?
I another place that sort of, if you, it's not, they have a little bit of food. There's a place in Copenhagen called Vedstraden 10 or something, I think. It's a natural wine bar. It's
V-E-D-S-T-R-A-D-E-N,
I think, two words. Vedstraden 10. I think 10 is the address.
That stood out to you?
Yeah, it's just a fun place that it's they've got they love wine, and they love sort of, it has the same sort of I don't know, that kind of excitement that Wild Air has.
Right.
Manfred's in Copenhagen. I don't know why I'm stuck on Copenhagen, but just in my mind.
Well, it's become a food center.
I would say one of the happiest sort of meals with a lot of wine that I've had in the last couple of years is Clown Bar in Paris.
Yes, very cool, good place.
Yeah, I love that spot.
Everyone in New York in wine that goes abroad
to the wine
ends
country.
Up there.
Ends up there. Yeah. You know, you see Instagram, yeah. Patrick Capiello, John Bonet, you know, they're all Laura Maniac. They all wind up there. All right. Maybe you can answer this. Favorite all-time wine. Is there a wine that you had through your years that was like, oh, my God.
See, I this
you
is,
may not be that kind of guy.
I'm not exactly that kind. I keep hitting this idea of story. So I like, you know, when I first started getting into food, someone poured me some Domaine Tempier from Bandol.
Great stuff.
Then you read about it, and there's this connection to a kind of early culinary food movement in California between Alice Waters and Richard Olney in France, and all this sort of Kermit Lynch. And then when I did the rosé story, I went to Bandol because of that, and I, you know, got to spend a little time there. And so
it's memorable.
Best wine I've ever had. It's a favorite sort of.
It's memorable. It
makes me happy to drink. And I would always drink champagne.
Champagne is the most underrated.
Even as highly rated as it is. The problem is it's rated for the wrong thing. It's rated as a
celebratory.
I don't like flutes.
Right.
I don't want a flute. I want a wine glass full of sort of vintage champagnes that smells like sherry and is poured out of a bottle that's bigger than my daughter.
So when you, I guess I'll use the word balked on the favorite wine and food pairing.
I rejected the question.
A lot of people in the past have said some interesting things with champagne. Champagne and popcorn, champagne and fried chicken. Champagne is a sleeper with pizza.
Yeah, you know
it basically goes, you know, with any food.
What they're saying is they like champagne and they like fried chicken.
Right.
Those things
happens to go well.
Yeah.
So we're okay with that. All right, last question on the wine list is tell me other writers you admire, you know, food,
wine, anything?
Yeah.
Oh, God. For living, dead? I'm clearly buying time.
Anywhere. Well, let's start
with... my favorite, my, like, writing heroes who are not alive, or like A.J. Liebling, who, you know, could write about Louisiana politics or boxing or horse racing or New York theater, but always talk about where he had lunch. And his food writing about Paris specifically... And New York was always came out of this sort of the joy of it and the indulgence of it and the pleasure of it, and then the stories around it.
Anyone else? about general writers?
General writers? I mean,
do you read a lot or are you too
I can
busy?
Read. I can read.
No, I know you can read. Do you read a lot or are you just busy to sit down and pour
I mean, I think
a
like
book?
A lot of us, I'm reading something constantly, but unfortunately it's my phone a lot of the time.
Right. It's not a book. I'm similar.
I try to read the New York Review of Books because I look smart if I carry it around, even if I...
Instead of reading the book, you talk about the book through the information from the review.
You can read a review that's the great sort of scam of that publication is that they take every interesting fact and put it right in the story.
It's the Cliff's Notes of current book reviews and all. It'll get you through a dinner for conversation.
It's wonderful. Yeah, would I ever read an entire history about American lighthouses? No, but that review of that was fascinating.
Right, that's all you need.
Or how trees communicate through their
roots. That's
a great
example, because that's the topic is interesting, but that's all you need to know.
Yeah, 400 pages of that. I don't have the time.
All right, we're going to move on, and we're going to move to our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, Adam brought in a Savoir Selects Wine Club selection. It's a 2014 Petit Syrah from California. Just a little background. Petit Syrah is also known as Duraf in Europe and around the world. And it's a tannic, spicy, plummy, you know, deep purple type wine. So Adam brought in the 2014. We poured it out. And Adam, let's drink it on the air and talk about it.
So, is there swirling music?
No.
Okay. You might want to get like a drum, something like a drum roll.
So color-wise,
that's fitting.
Color-wise, it's a deep purple wine, which is typical of a Petit Syrah. Petit Syrah shouldn't be confused with Syrah.
Right.
This is spelled S-I-R-A-H.
That's confusing.
Preceded by Petite. Syrah is very big in Australia in the Rhone region. All right, so it's a deep purple. The nose.
I'm smelling into the microphone.
The nose, you get that plummy, deep red fruits, some currants and all of that. And then let's give it a sniff one more time. Pick up anything else, Adam?
No, it's a yeah. So I already admitted I'm terrible with the wine.
All right,
wine
so
talk,
let's throw it over the tongue and let's see what we taste.
Is that the technical term?
Mm-hmm. So the first thing is the mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly unctuous wine. It's not a thin wine. It's got a medium to full body, which is nice. It's
but it doesn't hit you in the face either.
It's it's mouth coating.
It's not overstaying its welcome.
Right. And I'll back you against the wall again. Are you picking anything up on the palate, flavor-wise?
Some berries.
Dark berries.
I'm flipping through my notes to see if there's any cliff notes here. No, it's kind of warming and berry-ish. It's not too jammy. It's nice.
It is not too jammy, which is
tiny
nice.
Bit of pepperiness, maybe? I don't know.
Definitely pepper. Yeah. Great call. And it is definitely plummy and berry-like and all that. All right, so I know you hate this question, but I got to ask you this. If you were going to pair this wine with something, do you see it with stuff like red meat or heavier foods?
I think this could be great with red meat. I, like a lot of people, don't mind wine with red wine with fish.
Not at
all,
right?
We're adjacent to Roberto, so pizza is on my mind.
Be a good
I think
pizza
this would be
wine.
Great with some sort of sausagey thing with a little bit of red pepper.
Red sauce.
You know, some red pepper flakes in there. I think this would be a pretty versatile wine. And one of the idea of this wine club is to...
Well, I wanted to talk to you about that. So let's talk about the wine club. It's set up through Savor. You could buy four bottles or two bottles. So take it from there.
Yeah, the idea is instead of going out and buying specific wines from winemakers... And putting out there under their label, this is meant to be a little bit where each bottle is kind of showing off a region or a grape, or introducing people to Petit Syrah, for instance.
Right.
And I think you get four bottles per shipment, $75 each, and then we're going to introduce a two bottle club for $38.99.
And how does that work? It's not monthly, is it? Or
it is six shipments a year.
So you commit to six shipments, the four bottles, or it'll go to two.
Yeah. Right. And the idea is each one is supposed to have a little story with it. So we send out some material with recipes. So there is some pairing.
Food
there.
Pairing.
So this pairing isn't bullshit.
Right.
But it's our content. It's Savore content, and it's like the name implies, it's Savore selected. But the idea is not that we're going at them. Picking wines that you can, we're competing with your wine store. It's to sort of introduce you to an expression of wine or a grape or a region that maybe you're unfamiliar with.
Well, I could tell you a couple of interesting things. The four wines that are available in the club right now are Gewürztraminer, which is a great white wine from Germany and Austria. It actually goes well with Chinese food and other stuff. You don't see it around a lot, so it's interesting that it's one of the selections. The Petit Syrah, which is not your typical California red wine. You are doing a Viognier, which is a Rhone white varietal, which is a very fragrant, delicious wine. And, people are used to Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, so the idea of introducing that. And then your only European selection is a Coteau Bourguignon, which is a French red wine and all of that. So I think those are the four wines available. So if you're interested, you go to Savor Selects.
Savor.com/selects.
Okay.
Or if you just look up Savor Selects. We've got an Instagram account too. But check it out.
All right, so let's talk business a little. So for the wines, Savore / selects, you'll get to the wine.
Right.
If people want to go online and get more info or stories from the magazine, Savore.com?
Savore.com, yeah.
Okay.
And there's obviously wine coverage there. And
yeah, there's a treasure trove of I went through it. There's a ton of wine coverage. I mean, there's stories currently and that go back, and, you know, some of them are timeless. And what else? We covered everything.
We're done with the speed round. I can.
We're done with the speed round. You can relax.
What do you think? Is the wine opening up a little bit?
Well, that you know, I always ask my guests, do we like this wine?
Yeah.
And that's a loaded question to you, because if you don't like it, somebody's going to beat the shit out of you somewhere. But leave it to me. I mean, I think for the price. You know, you're looking at four bottles of wine. You're looking at 20 and under.
Yeah.
One of the questions I ask my guests, mostly sommeliers, wine people, is give me a white and a red for under $15.
And right.
This is close to that price range.
Absolutely.
And I think it sort of delivering. Hits that. And, you know, Adam was involved in the selection, not of the grapes or whatever, but the mindset of, you know, what we're doing.
We taste a fair number of wines, and we're picking this over this, and trying to pick what is the, you know, I keep saying story, but what's the story that's going to be useful for four bottles?
Right. It's a great idea. So
thanks.
Savore.com/selects. All right, we're wrapping up the show. If you have a question, a wine happening, or an event, hit me up at Sam at the Grape Nation. That's Sam at thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Twitter at Ben Ruby, and on Instagram at S Ben Ruby. We had to put that S in there. I want to thank Adam Sachs, editor-in-chief of Savore Magazine, for coming in and talking about food, wine, subjecting me to this Pinot Noir, me subjecting him to the wine list. I want to thank our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.